You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm George Ingram. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. We're here because we've just released a paper on USAID's public-private partnerships. And because there are different uses of the term, I want to make sure what we are talking about today and what we're not talking about. And we've identified three different main uses of the term. The first is what I would call contracting or infrastructure PPPs, as used principally by the World Bank, other international development institutions, the U.S. state governments. That really is a contracting relationship with a private company to finance and build a piece of public infrastructure, with the company getting compensated from the revenues that are generated by the infrastructure. A second form of public-private partnerships are multi-stakeholder alliances, such as Gavi. And they principally involve a vast number, a large number, of private entities, foundations, corporations, other public institutions that have an unlimited lifespan and tend to be single issues, single sector, almost informal international organizations that have a very formal governance structure. What we're talking about today is what I call development PPPs. And these involve a U.S. entity, a U.S. government entity, in this case today USAID, and private parties, private corporations, NGOs, foundations, tend to be focused on a transactionally, on a specific project and with a limited time span. This research began when USAID released a data set in mid-2014 on their 1,500 public-private partnerships. And I had and at that point, late 2014, I issued a very brief paper, which was a data picture of USAID's public-private partnerships. That led me, fortunately, to work for the next semester with Ann Johnson and Helen Moser on their capstone project at Georgetown. That was such a good collaboration that they agreed to work with me on my broader paper, which is what we're publishing today. Ann is now working at the Beck Center at Georgetown and at the IFC, and Helen is just down the street working for CSIS. They are going to give you a brief introduction, hopefully a teaser on the paper, and then I'm going to moderate a panel.
Thank you, George. It's been a pleasure for us to work with you on this over the last year and a half, and we're so appreciative to be here today. I will now give a brief data picture of USAID PPPs from 2001 to 2014. We did not use 2015 data for this analysis, as it was incomplete at the time. This graph shows the number of USAID PPPs by start year. For the 14-year period, the total number of PPPs is 1,481, and the average number of PPPs per year is 105. The average was 135 for 2004 to 2008, and this dropped to 90 for the last 3 years. This downward trend is likely reflective of the much broader array of mechanisms USAID has developed in recent years to engage the private sector, such as the Development Credit Authority, enterprise funds, and systemic platforms like Power Africa and Feed the Future. These graphs show the total number and investment value of USAID PPPs by region. The most number of partnerships are fairly evenly distributed among three regions. The left pie chart shows that the most number of PPPs are in Africa at 29%, and Latin America, Caribbean, and Asia vie for second place at 25% and 24% respectively. The right pie chart shows that by value, global PPPs surpass all others at 36% of the total, despite making up only 4% of the number of PPPs. Africa is in second place at 22%. This may reflect that global PPPs tend to be implemented in several countries and galvanize a coalition of major funders around an issue. These graphs show the total number and investment value of USAID PPPs by USAID development sector. The left pie chart shows that economic growth accounts for 22% of the number of PPPs and health for 21%. The right pie chart shows that by value, health dominates at 47%, and economic growth and agriculture compete for second place at 13% and 12%, respectively. Over 4,000 organizations have served as resource partners for USAID PPPs. And when we say resource partners, we mean organizations that contribute resources and share in the risk and governance of a PPP. This graph shows these partners broken down into the types of institutions that they represent. The most frequent resource partners are private businesses, which represent 38%, and in total, for-profit entities make up 53% of USAID partners, and you can see this in the graph in blue. Nonprofit entities are 32%, and governmental entities are 15%. These graphs break down the number and investment of local and non-local partners for fiscal year 2014. USAID released a more in-depth data set in 2014, and this is why we were able to do this analysis for that year. Local resource partners are those based in the PPP's implementation country or immediate region. And this is of interest to us given that USAID has really emphasized engaging local actors across its programming. The left pie chart shows that 52% of USAID PPP partners in 2014 are local entities, and 48% are non-local. The right pie chart shows that local partners in 2014 contribute 28% of the funding of all partnerships, whereas non-local partners contribute the majority of funding at 72%. I will now turn it over to Ann Johnson, and she is going to talk about the coding work we did to analyze the business presence and shared value in USAID PPPs.
Thanks, Helen. So as Helen mentioned, in addition to analysis on these overall trends, we also wanted to leverage these data further to look at the degree to which USAID's PPPs engage the private sector. Or the business sector, rather. And so we, for example, looked at three things. We looked at the presence of business sector partners in these PPPs. We looked at how many PPPs appear to be within the commercial interests of those PPP or of those partners. And third, we looked at any connections that the PPP activities may have to the core technical and managerial expertise of those business partners. And I'll describe each of these momentarily. So for the first one, presence of business sector partners, we found that 3/4 of USAID's PPPs appear to engage at least one type of business sector entity. This could be companies, financial institutions, industry associations, corporate foundations, and so forth. And as you see, this proportion has been relatively stable over time. The remaining quarter included other kinds of interesting non-public entities, such as philanthropies and nonprofits, but none that were directly associated with the business sector. Notably, PPPs that include business sector partners, which are shown on the left, receive relatively little of their funding, about 27%, shown in dark blue, from the U.S. government. But among PPPs with no business sector partners, shown on the right, U.S. government funding accounts for about half of the investment in those PPPs. Secondly, we coded PPPs for evidence that the PPP's activities were in the connected to the commercial interests of the business sector partners. So essentially, we were asking, does a given PPP exhibit shared value approaches? We found that over half of PPPs included activities that were clearly commercially beneficial to the private sector partners. So, for example, increasing demand for their product, building out their supply chains, improving the productivity of their workforce, and so on. An additional third exhibited what we called strategic benefit, and these PPPs were not directly related to profit making, but somehow were connected to the overall enabling environment for the firm, perhaps addressed some of their externalities or other long-term strategic considerations. The final 17% that you see in light blue, those PPPs were more or less philanthropically oriented. And here, too, we see that the more a business sector partner appears to benefit from a PPP, the more they are willing to invest in it vis-a-vis the U.S. government. And these analyses get more interesting as we start to compare the indicators with one another. So our third indicator here, connection to business partner expertise, looked at the degree to which PPPs were connected to the core managerial and technical capacities of those business sector partners. So, for example, is the business sector partner more or less just writing a check, or are they actually leveraging their day-to-day core knowledge and expertise in implementing a PPP, such as when, say, a coffee company works with local coffee cooperatives to improve their yields and livelihoods. And so we found, as you see on the screen, that 80% of PPPs are in some way connected to the technical capacities of those companies. And like the two prior indicators, business sector partners are more willing to invest in the PPPs when it's linked to their own business business expertise, but they rely more heavily on USAID to pick up a tab in PPPs that are not related to their expertise. Now, where this gets interesting is when we combine indicators with one another. So, for example, this slide shows that a firm's contribution of expertise is also much higher when the firm stands to benefit from the outcomes of those PPPs. So, for example, you see that among commercial benefit PPPs, almost all, or 98%, also appear to receive technical knowledge from those business sector partners. But this drops to 80% among strategic benefit PPPs and down to just 18% in those philanthropic-oriented PPPs. So, in summary, the business sector is both willing to invest more money and also more of their expertise in PPPs that are directly related to their core activities and in which they stand to benefit. We also found that commercial benefit is more common among PPPs in low-income countries than in richer countries. We don't know why this is, but one might surmise that it is because companies are less likely to participate in initiatives in countries that are unrelated to their core business and more likely to do so if they have a commercial rationale for doing so. We also conducted analyses similar to those that Helen showed earlier based on region and sector, but because our time is limited, you will just have to read our report.
With me. And literally, this project could not have been done in this way without their involvement. My second big success was in recruiting this panel. And each member of this panel is deeply steeped in knowledge and experience of public-private partnerships and related issues. And I couldn't be more pleased that you all joined us here today. So thank you. You have their bios before you, so I will just make brief introductions. Jane Nelson is the Director of Corporate Responsibility at Harvard Kennedy School and is a non-resident fellow at Brookings. She's one of the most knowledgeable, respected, and sought-after experts on public-private partnerships, shared value, CSR, and related issues. And she uniquely bridges the distance between academia, the corporate world, and the policy world. Anne Mae Chang is the Chief Innovation Officer, which you can tell us what is at some point, and the Executive Director of the Lab at USAID. And she has, as far as I can tell, she has made a career out of innovation. First in Silicon Valley with Google, then with Mercy Corps, where that was your position. She brought innovation to the State Department, no laughs, and now is doing that at USAID. Sarah and Joanna probably have more experience in managing their company's relationships with USAID than any other two corporate executives in Washington. Chevron has done 33 public-private partnerships with AID, and Walmart has done 13. Joanna, who manages development and public policy at Chevron, has had a career focused on global development and food security. And before Chevron, like Helen, was down the street at CSIS. So there's a CSIS Brookings connection here going on today. Sarah, at the end, is responsible for international policy at Walmart, and that includes a range of legislative issues and trade negotiations. And she joined Walmart after working at the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Now, to start the conversation, we undertook this research because over the last 5 years or so, there's been a lot of attention to public-private partnerships, but very little information on what they entail. Anne and Helen have given you a glimpse of our findings. Among them are that, actually they didn't present this, but it's in the book, the report, 1 or 2% of AID's funding every year goes to public-private partnerships. There have been fewer in recent years than 10 years ago. And aid is moving to emphasizing other mechanisms besides public-private partnerships for engaging the private sector. Anne May, if I can start with you, the report references your colleague Eric Postel in describing the evolution of AID's engagement over 50 years of engaging the private sector. First 1.0 is at the macro level of influencing the enabling environment. 2.0, the last 15 years, is more transactional, project-oriented, and represented by public-private partnerships. And now, sort of, the new trend is towards systemic engagement. Where do PPPs fit in AID's toolkit of engaging the private sector? And how does this fit, put it in a really broad context, which allows you to talk about anything you want to, of how does this fit in with the ADIS agenda and the SDGs, really elevating the emphasis of the role of the corporate sector and the private sector in promoting economic and social development?
Great. That's a pretty broad question.
That's a broad question.
You know, as you talked about my background, you know, I've spent time in the private sector, in the NGO sector, and now in the public sector. And, you know, I often say that I think magic happens at the intersection of sectors because each of the sectors brings unique assets and also limitations. And it's sort of by leveraging the strengths of each sector that we really can achieve more together than we can individually. I think how this applies to ADIS and the new Sustainable Development Goals is it's really clear that we're not going to be able to fund our way to the Sustainable Development Goals. You know, we're like 10x off the amount of money that we actually need, that people have calculated, that we need to actually meet those goals. The way we're going to get there, I think, is through two things. One is through innovation and having breakthrough innovations that get us much more bang for the buck. And the other is through partnerships, by really leveraging private resources that can dramatically multiply what we're able to do from a public resource standpoint. And so as you talk about the evolution of partnerships at USAID, I would say it's less an evolution in terms of one replacing the other, so much as adding tools to our toolbox, right? Mm-hmm. So I still think there remains and will continue to remain a very critical role for public-private partnerships for ways that we engage in specific projects with specific companies in particular geographies. And in addition, I think one of the evolutions that we are doing more of now, in addition, is the sort of multi-sectoral partnerships, you know, things like Gavi, things like Power Africa, that really look at how can we move an industry by removing policy barriers, by catalyzing finance, and so forth, that go beyond any individual project.
And so, give us a little bit more on, I've heard people in the last 6 months at AID talking about moving to a systems approach, and I think you got to it right there at the end.
Yes.
But elaborate on that just a little bit.
Well, I think the systems approach is going out beyond an individual project and looking at what are the systemic barriers. So, for example, if you take Power Africa, what are the systemic barriers to actually providing electricity to the billion or so people that live in Africa? You know, in some countries, there are barriers because of policy or regulatory issues. And so now we're looking at tying financing to making some of those policy changes so that the enabling environment becomes more conducive. There's issues about de-risking financing because some of these countries are not always the most stable places, and people may be hesitant to put in their money because of fear of, you know, the risk that's involved. And so where we can kind of de-risk that money through, you know, first loss positions and things like that, it helps catalyze more financing to go into those countries. And sometimes there's legal barriers or political barriers, again, that we can help remove. And so it's that systemic approach that enables the whole pie to grow, if you will.
So it almost ties 1.0 and 2.0 together of the transactional with the macro and enabling environment.
Yeah.
Thanks. Jane, you look at PPPs through your academic lens and through your role as advising corporations and getting on in the inside of corporations. What is the role of public-private partnerships for corporations, and how does this relate to CSR and shared value? Where is it headed? Is this just a temporary fad, or is this something that we're going to see built up in the coming years?
Great. Well, thank you, George, and good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be here. I definitely don't think it's a temporary fad, and you agree with what Anne May said, that I think public-private partnerships have been and will continue to be an incredibly important tool, both from the development community's perspective in terms of improving aid effectiveness and development impact, but also I think from the perspective of the private sector, partnerships play to me two very, very important roles. One is, depending on the partnership, helping companies better manage risk, improve the enabling environment, the sort of strategic environment they're operating in. And secondly, as Anne May was saying, help them to innovate and find new opportunities, create shared value. And I think if you look at those sort of two broad motivations from a company perspective of your better risk management and enabling environment and opportunities to create shared value, new products, new services, et cetera, I think there's sort of two broad categories of partnership that really matter, and we've already discussed both of them, but one are the more transactional, sort of project-based, product development, product-based partnerships, where you'll have one company working with USAID, possibly an NGO, maybe another company, an ICT company, working with a financial services company, specifically to develop new products, new technologies, new services, strengthen supply chains, develop new social investment models, but very much on a project-by-project basis. But if they're commercially viable, real potential to scale, even on a project basis. But I think, as Anne May was saying, just as, you know, the donors have recognized these sort of broader systemic constraints, which basically break down into either market failures or governance gaps, I think the corporate sector has realized, well, we know however good our project-based partnerships are, and they will continue to do those, both, you know, commercially and philanthropically, we need to get engaged in what Helen calls sort of systemic platforms or collective action initiatives. And some of those will be like Gavi and, you know, become institutions in their own right. But I think a lot of them, and to me the most interesting ones, are alliances like Power Africa, Feed the Future, at a sort of both global, but often operating at a national level, where you'll get an alliance of a group of companies coming together, government comes to the table and commits to do policy reforms, the donors come to the table and provide donor financing, you know, often, you know, for risk sharing or advocating government to improve its policies, and then business comes to the table with investments and core competencies. And different companies are doing different things, but it's happening within a much broader platform and systemic alliance. And I think both, you know, increasing the product-based and then project-based partnerships and the number of those, but also these more systemic-level collective action initiatives are sort of where I see two key trends, and certainly from the business perspective, and Joanna and Sarah will be able to give more in-depth examples, companies realizing that they've got to work often on a pre-competitive basis with some of their biggest competitors to overcome some of the systemic constraints because of either market failures or governance gaps.
And to what extent is this a global movement? And are we seeing, it's not just the U.S., it's Europe, it's developing countries?
Yep. Absolutely. I think it's, I feel very much global. I think within developing countries, you're seeing more and more local companies recognizing that they need to have sort of industry-wide systemic partnerships. You're seeing alliances emerge because of crises. So the Bangladesh Alliance and the Bangladesh Accord, we've got sort of two almost competing alliances, but you know, European companies taking one route, American companies, that's a bit of a simplification, but you know, taking another, but both working collectively with you know, labor unions, with donor governments, with the Bangladesh government, to try and improve working conditions in Bangladesh. So some of these alliances are very much around spreading responsible business practices, improving human rights, managing broader risks. Others, and I'd say Feed the Future, Power Africa, are about mobilizing resources and innovation and both you know, financial resources as well as products and technical skills and technical capabilities.
Thank you. Joanna and Sarah, Chevron and Walmart have engaged in multiple PPPs over the last 15 years. How is your approach to those evolved and why? And again, as I try to put it in the broader context, because I think, to use Anne May's term of innovation, one thing that's innovative for all of us today comes out, again, of Addis and the SDGs, of where the development community is recognizing that the private sector has a big role to play in advancing development, and we're seeing that the corporate sector recognizes that role too. So put it in that context.
Sure, I'll go. If you want to
go ahead.
So, you know, we've been on a journey, I would say, as a company to figure out what our role is in global development. And part of it is because our company has been on a journey moving into emerging markets. So when I joined the company 9 years ago, we were really in Mexico, China, and we were exiting Germany and exiting South Korea. Now we're in 28 markets around the world. The majority of those are emerging markets. And so our business imperative has changed as I think the development community has changed, also in the acceptance, quite frankly, of the business community in terms as an actor in global development. And we've been very fortunate that we've had a very patient partner in USAID because our thinking has changed and I think we've sort of pushed and pulled each other along. Our early partnerships, I think, were under the Global Development Alliance. So it was really about our money, you know, we're going to leverage, you know, and we love the term leverage. It's a great term. It means we can do more together. But, you know, as we started to get into our partnerships, we recognized that the money is probably the least interesting part of what we do. It's absolutely essential. You need sometimes patient capital to overcome market failures and to build capacity. But as a business, you know, we buy a lot of stuff and we hire a lot of people. We have 2.1 million people who work for us around the world, and we're the world's largest grocer. And that gives us a really unique ability to partner to try to accelerate in a more inclusive way the buying and the hiring, and thinking about if we're in these emerging markets, there's a business interest for me to have competitive market economies around me, to have opportunity for employ people. And so, you know, we look at that lens, and as a business, when we look at how we partner or how we go after large societal objectives, we use the business as an agent in change. And so we started to bring that approach to our partnerships to say, okay, it's great. I'm happy to lend my foundation money towards this end, but I think it's probably more interesting if we use that sourcing. So a good example is our work on engaging smallholder farmers, and I see a lot of our partners here who have been just, again, amazing partners to us in teaching us and helping us do this in the right way. We in the markets around the world recognize very quickly that there are real failures in farming in terms of you have farmers producing, but then you had people touching that product along the end that weren't adding any value. So if we could go direct to farmers, we could have a better opportunity to get a better, fresher product into our market, probably at a better price for our customers. And so then the question is, how do you do that effectively? In certain markets, we have agronomists on staff, we have relationships with local farmers, and we needed maybe an intermediary to help us expand our reach. And so in Central America, we started years ago working with USAID to help bring more of those farmers into our supply chain. And what we could teach them was, what do we actually want to source? You know, somebody years ago told you, corn and beans, that's what you should produce. And actually, I've been on the farms, and I said, why were you make why corn and beans? And they said, well, you know, these guys told us these were a great crop. And we say, okay, well, if we want to actually bring this to market, we need onions, we need cilantro, we need tomatoes. At some point, we will not import bananas into El Salvador. We should probably grow those there. You know, things like that. What is the market signal we can give? What is the information we can give on what standards we need? And how do we work collectively to build trust also? Because the private sector isn't always the most trusted actor. So how do we have partnerships so that we have trust and understanding that when we say inclusive growth, we mean inclusive growth? And so that really has put us on a path to think always about, you know, what's the business imperative? How do we do this to make sense? How do we do well and do good? What's the best way to partner collectively? And then how do we actually work either private-private, public-private? So when we think of partnerships, we think Walmart to NGO. There's a lots of opportunities to come to this goal. And I like the talk about systemic because I think that's where we're getting to, which is what we want to create are sustainable partnerships. So what frustrated us about the old model was money, partnership. It ends. It's time limited and everybody goes away and we do our metrics and evaluation. And we were talking about this yesterday and we say we train this many people, check. But is that truly sustainable? Is that actually making real change? And oftentimes it's not because there's systems failures. And so really looking more holistically at this approach to say, I think we need to step back and we need to look at all the levers to make sure we're actually moving on a partnership platform that's going to lead to systemic change and growth. And for us, it's really our niche is economic development. It really is. So how do that's kind of where we want to play. I'm seeing now some criticism from other actors in that the private sector is only interested in economic development. Well, I think we need to be honest about doing what we're good at. And that's where we're good at, and that's really where we truly want to partner. We can do other social factors, environment, labor, all of these things, but it's around this rubric of sustainable economic development.
Well, I want to first congratulate Anne and Helen. This is great because I feel like we've been having a partnership conversation for a long time and we now have some data and some analysis, which always brings a conversation to a totally different level. And congratulations to you, George, for finding these two.
You should congratulate me for supporting them on doing such great work.
So the conversation and the arrangements around partnerships have truly been, they've changed so much over the past 10 years. There's been so much opportunity for innovation. There's been so much learning that I think I love Eric Postel's, you know, point about partnerships 4.0 and what we're doing and your points about systemic change. Those are really helpful aiming points to be at. While at the same time, when I look at partnerships, so Chevron's right now going through a rethink of our partnership strategy. So what actually do we want out of partnerships? So initially with USAID, we're 33 partnerships and $130 million in. USAID is by far, in every case, our preferred partner. We want to talk to you first. And it comes from, first of all, Chevron is somewhat topically agnostic. We do a lot of research and stakeholder interviews to say, okay, so if we're going to be in this community, we want to be productive and engaged, what do you want? And so we'll do hundreds of interviews with people to say, what do you want? Usually what people want falls into our three broad categories of economic development, and that ends up actually being a lot of agriculture in many cases. It's education and it's health. So all things are very much aligned with USAID. So we want to go where the data leads us, but in the end, where we are fixed is in location. So where we are is really important. And we have a model not dissimilar from AID in the State Department, which is where we have, you know, strong operational centers in different countries around the world and a lot of local innovation that we want to make sure can really thrive with support from sort of headquarters level strategy and planning. But I would say that while the entire field has changed and in our strategy rethink, we're trying to say, how does 1 + 1 not just equal 2? How does it equal 10 or 20? What are the elements of that? How are our implementing partners, because a lot of times, Chevron can't teach farmers how to raise cassava, but our implementing partners can. So how do we work more closely with our implementing partners to help them leverage more funds and leverage more engagement and leverage more impact? Both from what we're spending and who we're working with, we want to see more impact. We want to find ways to do that. And so that's some of our thinking right now. But in the end, really back to basics, I think it's really important. Are we aligned around values? Do we share the same goals and vision for what we're doing together? And with USAID, I think that's, we've tried a lot of different things and some haven't progressed, but the ones that have been around, we want to help Angola stabilize and rebuild after the war. Well, that, what does that take? It takes stuff the Chevron didn't know how to do, like seed distribution and banking, but we did those together. In the Niger Delta, peace and prosperity. Well, how do you get there? Well, it's through partnerships. It's through engaging a really large swath of different actors. So when you start from that high-level alignment, you can get to the more specific points, but if you don't have alignment, you don't have anything. I think communications, everyone would say communications is absolutely essential. And it's when you're partnering and when you're not partnering, because those conversations you have over coffee or whatever are what makes you realize, hey, wait a minute, we're trying to do the same thing. And I never knew you were working in that area or on that issue. So having those ongoing high-level relationships is really essential. And then a third thing I would say, and this is so critical and never gets talked about, but from company standpoint, we have enormously deep and rigorous compliance responsibilities. We have financial compliance. We have, FCPA and human rights and all of the other values that we stand by, and we know USAID does too. So it's natural to work with USAID because we share many of the same processes. And most of the development agencies, DFID or the Australian Aid Agency, looking at those best practices, we have to work with groups that do that. So that's why these partnerships have been so important. I think in terms of where things might go, it is more leverage. What's happened, I think, with SDG conversation, I get a little nervous when people say, oh, there's not enough money to pay for it all, so we need the private sector. When in reality, it's more what you're saying. It's actually, you don't need the private sector. You need people in countries and communities to have jobs, to make money, to support their families, to have good governments, to advocate for themselves. It's that catalyzing effect of what we do that's really important. When I think systemic change, I feel like, well, that maybe is overwhelming for people. But what's happened in countries... is that a lot of countries just have more resources. They have better educated people today than they did 20 or 30 years ago. There's more income. There's more tax income. If you look at the domestic resource mobilization work and analysis, there are resources and money and people and stronger civil societies in countries. And so what we've looked at in some of our areas is like we can put in $30 million to something, but that's a lot of money for a company, but it's a drop in the bucket for what maybe is needed to change. So finding ways to partner and bring all sectors to the table and talk about what do you want out of, your situation and what can we do to help and what can we do to train and how can citizens actually figure out their own path rather than us sort of plopping down a project. I think that it's a really important movement, and it's truly, around demand-driven development, and I think something that some partnerships have touched but not all, so finding ways to bring those basic principles back and cement them is really important while we innovate and change and grow into new areas.
Thank you. One of the things that you mentioned about the compliance requirements and the similar values that Chevron has with AID relates to one of the surprising findings in my conversations with the 17 corporate executives. A number of them said that partnering with USAID is a way to manage their risk. Because AID has networks in these countries, may have already vetted companies in the country, and I just never had thought about that being one of the benefits that AID brings
it's
to
a
the
bedrock.
PPPs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Shared value. There's lots of conversation in recent years about shared value, where you have the linkage of a corporate business interest and a public good. We avoid the term in the paper because it's used so many different ways. And Anne showed you the terms we do use, and that over half the PPPs that USAID is engaged in involved some form of direct corporate commercial interest, and another quarter of them involved a broader strategic commercial interest. So it seems pretty clear that the corporate community and AID have found this sweet spot where their interests are joined together. Jane, What is the trend in bringing the corporate interests together with the public good? And is this the holy grail of PPPs? Is that what we should be expecting from PPPs and not pay so much attention to philanthropic ones? Or is this just a niche market for a few corporations?
Quite a few questions there, but I think to me it's not necessarily the holy grail. I mean, it's no doubt that it's grown dramatically in both the number of commercially driven partnerships as well as the sort of the different range of commercial interests. But I very much applaud what you did with the paper, breaking down sort of your direct profit-making commercial interests and then the sort of strategic benefit, but still very clear business interest.
We did that after consulting with Jane,
well,
and she approved
it. Lots of other people. But because I think that there definitely are more partnerships where there is a direct profit-making potential, product development, a new drug discovery and development, financial inclusion, a digital inclusion, and some of the supply chain, including smallholders and supply chains, where the company has the potential to make direct profits and scale up both the profit-making and the development impact, which is the heart of what Michael Porter and Mark Cramer would call shared value. And they need, as Anne May was saying earlier, possibly some seed capital or risk sharing at the outset or some help with changing a government policy or something to get there. So I think we're seeing more of those types of partnerships, definitely. But I think we need to be careful not to say, well, those are going to be the only types of partnership. I think those are the partnerships that definitely have the potential to scale, whether it's multinational companies or local companies. I mean, particularly if you're looking at sort of goods and services that are currently not affordable or accessible to the poor, whether it's electricity or food, or medicines. But I think the sort of strategic benefit category is really important. And Joanna sort of, I think, gave some great examples there where if you're a company that actually has to be in a certain location, there's a real business imperative to make sure that there's stability and security in that location. And that requires on a combination of peace building, good governance, capability building in terms of education, health systems, and economic development. And the company might not get direct profit opportunities from doing some of those things, but it's really important to the broader environment in which the company's operating in. Mm-hmm. Or some of the human rights and labor working conditions partnerships that we're seeing, which sometimes you can say, well, they lead to greater productivity, and often they do, but it's more about meeting fundamental standards and values and working together to do it. So I think when we talk about the sort of commercial interests, it's useful to break down between those profit-making opportunities where public dollars could make discovery of a particular drug for an elective tropical disease possible, which wouldn't have been possible otherwise, and then it scales up, or the mobile banking that scales up. But where USAID can work with companies on sort of improving that broader sort of strategic benefit to the company, I think is very important, and strengthening health systems, education systems, peace building, et cetera. And then thirdly, I do think there's still a role for philanthropic partnerships. And, Sarah, you were saying you can use the foundation dollars, so the company can use its own foundation dollars to seed innovation or to support a health system strengthening partnership. But I think we can also use philanthropic dollars in humanitarian response where there's often a critical need just for those dollars to go out the door. Product donations are another great example. You always hear how short-term business is in its perspective, and I love to give the Merck example of the Mectazine donation program for river blindness, which has been going for, I think, 26 years now and reached millions of people. And it's a product donation, and they've made a commitment to keep doing it. So I think it's sort of useful to look at all three of those drivers, the directly, either immediately commercially viable, but you wouldn't really need the partnership in quite the same way. So you need a partnership to make something commercially viable over the longer term and potentially scale as a result. Partnerships to sort of improve the broader operating environment within which business is operating. So there's still a direct business benefit. But then also leveraging corporate philanthropic dollars, technical expertise, and products. I was just chatting to Anne May earlier, some of the pharmaceutical companies whose scientists are sort of providing basically volunteer time, but with the company's support, and compound screening and a whole series of sort of scientific expertise, which is probably never going to be commercially viable to the company, but could be very valuable to a development partner. Great. So I think all three of those are important, but no doubt that the shared value ones are increasing. And I think, and Anne May, you might want to comment on this, I think the development community has got much more comfortable with saying, you know, we are going to provide seed funding for something that's going to become profitable. And so profit is no longer a dirty word in the development community.
Let me just tee you up.
Yes, please.
And that is, while most of the paper, that part of the paper, looks at the commercial connection, we do acknowledge the value of philanthropic PPPs and use the example of UPS providing its logistic capabilities for humanitarian. But AMA, I really want you to address the same question. I'm going to use the same issue of the Holy Grail, because that's as close as I can get to stark language that is more the common language of this political times we're in right now. I can't get any worse than that. Because I could see AID looking at PPPs that involve the commercial, direct commercial connection to a company as saying, wow, if we can get this into the corporation's core business, then this is something that's more likely to continue after the project's over and lead to a real sustainable activity. Mm-hmm. And is that the case? And AID values those type of PPPs over ones that don't have as strong a connection to the business interest?
So absolutely, I think sustainability is really important. I would break down the problem slightly differently. So when I think about shared value, there's different ways. Shared value to me means that we're bringing the best from different partners together and leveraging each other. And I think to be smart about any partnership, we want to leverage the most possible from each other in complementary ways. Because the reality is the cost of a partnership is actually significant. It's not a free thing. And so there's got to be enough benefit to overcome that. And I think in the early days, we may have just done partnerships for partnership's sake and probably gotten less out than we put in. And I think more and more we're looking for those complementary assets that we can bring together, whether it is about a private sector company's reach or their brand or their infrastructure or their technical expertise that brings something that we might not have as USAID and where 1 + 1 = more than 2. So I think that in all partnerships we do, we want to look at that. In terms of sustainability, I'm a huge fan of sustainability, and I would say that not all problems we're trying to solve can be solved in a sustainable way. You know, if we're trying to fight Zika virus, right, if we're trying to deal with a humanitarian crisis, these are not necessarily things you can do in a sustainable way, but they are things that the private sector can still really help with. But on the sustainability front, I think where there are opportunities, and I think Walmart's been a phenomenal leader in this, of being able to align business interests and a profitable business venture with a, you know, sort of development need, there's incredible leverage there, right? So if you think about, you know, we often talk about we leverage $1 of USAID money for $3 of private sector money. But if it's sustainable and you're getting $3 of benefit year after year after year, the net present value of that investment, you know, just magnified a few orders of magnitude, right? And so we need to think about that sustainability as sort of magnifying the leverage we've actually brought in looking at the value that we're creating. And again, it's not possible for every type of problem we're solving, but where it is, I think it's incredibly valuable. And one thing I would say is that I think we're still in the infancy of understanding this. You know, where, you know, in the report, I think it's fantastic the way that you guys were able to break out the kind of commercial and strategic interests. It's still, we don't have the data yet, even internally, to really say, which, you know, in preparing for this panel, I was asking our partnerships team, okay, so give me some examples of partnerships that are sustainable. Which ones are sustainable? And the answer is that basically, after the partnership is over, we don't have the money to go back and find out whether they're sustainable, right? So we don't actually have that data. And I think it's really important for us to learn which of these things really are continuing to go and thrive beyond the end of the partnership and the value that it accrues to, you know, sort of what we got for the money we invested. And we don't know that yet. And I think that's the next step of something we should learn more about.
Joanna and Sarah are going to answer your question for you, because that's what I was going to ask them.
Great.
And that is where the commercial link ties into their approach. And do you have examples of PPPs you've engaged with that has changed your behavior in a way that advances a public good or has led to an activity that has outlived the PPP? And before you answer, let me apologize to you in the back. I should have invited you up to the front. You should have followed this gentleman here. And please walk down the center aisle. It's quicker, or along the sides, because there are seats here in the front. Your feet must be getting tired.
So I may change your question a little bit, because I think, you know, and I love the data. I would hate to think that partnerships are so reductionist to think that they're only commercial.
Yeah,
and I think
exactly.
Jane has done a nice job of explaining the variety of partnerships. You know, one of the things we've done with USAID, though, is several years ago we said, you know, we're two pretty big entities, and we need to think about a framework for engagement. So we created a memorandum of understanding, and Dr. Shaw came to the mothership of Bentonville, Arkansas, and you know, and it was a really great opportunity for us to say and really think more constructively of how do we want to work together? What are the core of where when we look at our, you know, our mission in our corporate responsibility, we're looking at a couple of things. We're looking at sustainability, certainly environmental sustainability, but also social sustainability, opportunity, helping people with mobility and opportunity and skills, and then community, which is story of the community, but also disaster assistance and all of that we do. And so we created a framework around that. So yes, we do partnerships that we think are sustainable. I mean, certainly our work in Central America has broadened from training farmers to, and I love seeing this when the farmers trained decide and say, and they straight up move up the value chain. So I'm going to sell you tomatoes, but tomorrow I'm selling you tomato sauce, and I am going to create chopped vegetables that are going to get a better return and a better value because they're pre-made soup mixes. And to me, and you know what? Then I'm going to sell to you in El Salvador, but I have so much surplus supply that you're going to get into the jet stream of global sourcing, and you're going to go to our stores around the world. That, to me, is an amazing success story because it's very organic. And the growth is, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges I saw when I came into this is we had these partnerships that were, Walmart, we want you to buy jewelry from a cooperative in West Africa and sell at Sam's Club, which makes, it's wonderful. And it did make a difference. And the income went to those women. But it was really hard to replicate. And the amount of effort that went into making that particular partnership work, we could have just written a check. We honestly could have written a check and they would have had the same income. So really made us think about, okay, this we need to find a way that we match our scale. We help these smaller producers learn our systems, learn our processes, create an organic development. And so I used to always say, oh, we want to be part of your global value chains. And I'd say, no, you actually really want to be part of our local value chains. Yeah. And you want to grow with us, and we want to scale together. And the same idea we've had when we're working with women's economic empowerment, these women-owned businesses that, you know, may need real practical training to become a Walmart supplier, but honest to goodness, may have a much lower delta in terms of what we need in terms of the standards that we're requiring of them, in terms of transportation costs and logistics costs and liability insurance. They may be much better off starting local with us, learning us, and then going global. And so that's when I think of those really sustainable partnerships. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, as we've created this, you know, way of engaging with USAID, with relationship managers, where we're air traffic controllers, and we make sure we know who's talking to whom and what we're talking about, and again around this framework, the learning component of a partnership with AID is really important, mm-hmm. because sometimes we'll just convene and we'll bring all your experts into our offices and we'll say, we're looking at West African cashews. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. Could you guys, who are you partnering with? What have you learned? Can we learn from some of your failures? Can we learn from some of your successes? That to me is sometimes almost more valuable than, okay, we created this partnership and we worked on this. Because I think that the knowledge sharing is equally important.
And I would pick up there because I think that's really where we need to go is in joint sharing and learning across the board, because there's so many similarities and so many learnings that are happening. In October, I was with AID's team in Indonesia, which has just done phenomenal things. And they've gone out and they've asked Indonesians, what do you want from your partnership with the United States of America through USAID? And they came away with four focus areas, and they're embedding the private sector into everything they can. It's just incredibly sophisticated. So our folks will sit down with them and come up with, you know, an equally sophisticated approach that we can learn from each other. And I think institutionalizing some of those learnings is helpful as well. But I think we're still on shared value, so I don't want to ignore that question. And certainly I think Chevron's engagement, every single type of partnership we do is focused on business needs and business drivers. So I always take a little bit of issue that it's not directly business driven, but I imagine you put us kind of in the strategic partnership area. But I would say from the very top of the company and from the country managers who have a great deal of responsibility and autonomy of everything that happens on their watch, there is a tremendous commitment to what are we doing in the community that makes a difference for the community. That is core to our business. Listening to people in the community, listening to the host governments around their needs and priorities and goals is where we can really, you know, have an alignment. And then, and more often than not, those goals and priorities are oftentimes aligned with AID and DFID and AusAID and others who are operating in the country. So our shared value really is around how can we be a partner in the community? How can the community see us as contributors? It's less, you know, directly into our commercial lines, although in some cases that's worked well. But in a lot of cases, communities are looking for ways to, in countries, to ways to grow their workforce, to grow their skills, to sometimes move, you know, out of a rural area into a more urban area into, you know, white-collar employment or something different. So it's really listening and finding what people need, which is what creates the shared value, I think, from an extractive company like Chevron.
Great. I want to turn to the audience in a minute, but I don't want to lose the opportunity to talk about metrics. To talk about what you talked about, Sarah, and I gather you were involved in a panel discussion that, and we don't have time for the whole conversation yesterday, but one of the disappointments we had in this research is we found very little evaluation assessment of impact and couldn't get a good handle on how AID, on how the corporations track the PPPs and try to measure, assess the impact, and learn from them. So without taking too much time, and I want you to start off, Sarah, and give us a little bit of the panel yesterday, and then talk about how your organizations deal with the issue of metrics.
Sure. Well, Avery is here, and she moderated yesterday.
Okay, come on up, Avery.
Really well. But I think what we were talking about is the evolution of evaluating outputs to really looking holistically at outcomes. Where we'll say we trained 1 million farmers, which, you know, we will. But what does that mean? What did we learn? And what would we do again and what wouldn't we do again? I think from a private sector, when we think of metrics and evaluation, it's a little less numerically focused and a little more about learning and sort of an evolving learning landscape. Whereas I think sometimes, you know, people will say, well, we have to have the metrics. And it could be that you did train the farmers and their incomes went up, but you also, we've seen in some of our partnerships, you created other problems, you know? So, yes, the partnership was a success, but, you didn't realize that this happened, you know, because we weren't looking more systemically. So I think what we ended up deciding was we need to think really carefully up front about what we're trying to measure. We need to use new tools, new data points, new medias. So whether it's the social, you know, how you can crowdsource and get information from different sources, but also really to think about the different ways people think about metrics, because for the private sector, it's okay to say it didn't go well. That's okay. You know, that we may actually learn more from failure than trying to say we spent your money really well.
John?
We always have a desire for data, but fortunately our quantitative people are willing to be a little qualitative when it comes to this social stuff, because I think as a starting point you have to have a baseline, so those stakeholder interviews and discussions that we conduct provide a really good baseline for how do people feel about things, what do people think, so that we can go back and ask questions again and say, have things changed, have your opinions changed, have your situations changed, and have those kinds of engagements. But one of the challenges is, when is it too much? So trying to find the right balance between, yeah, we need some data, we need to understand where people are in their lives and their thinking, but at a certain point, if it's not driven toward a particular outcome or toward a particular change, you can blow your budget and overdo your data collection to the point where it's not useful. So I think that there's no perfect ending spot for your monitoring and evaluation. You have to build in a way to understand where you start, understand where you want to go, and just find benchmarks along the way that indicate are you in the ballpark of where you wanted to be or not, and assess from there.
Emily?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of M&E, although what I would say is historically when we look at M&E and development, it's been from an accountability standpoint, like, you know, are you corrupt? Did you waste our money? Right? And so it becomes a little bit of a punitive checkbox thing. And what we're trying to do is shift the dialogue about M&E to one about learning. And so we're at the lab, one of the things we've been doing is we have a new mechanism called Merlin, which we are actually experimenting with new M&E tools, and with a particular eye towards how do you understand outcomes in more complex situations, and how do you understand outcomes much more quickly so that it's not like the obligatory midline and endline evaluation that gets stuck on the shelf, but it's about like data points that we're getting back from our users and customers every day, every week, every month that help us continue to inform and improve our programs. You know, just from coming from Silicon Valley, you know, I'm used to having the dashboard every morning that tells me sort of how our experiment went and then tweaking our algorithms, right? And we don't have that in development, and I think it's one of the reasons that we're not able to make as rapid progress in development as we are in Silicon Valley is because we don't have that data feedback loop, and so we really want to build that in. I think the other part that is a challenge for us that we're just starting to talk about is this question I brought up earlier, where a lot of the outcomes you can't really tell until after the end of the program.
Right.
And the way we're structured, our engagement really ends at that point. We have no more money to spend. We have no more people involved at the end of the program. And so we need to figure out how do we actually deploy resources to look back, again, to learn so that that better informs how we design programs in the future.
And how big is the problem for AID that Sarah mentioned in one sentence, because this could be the topic of a whole other panel, of being able to admit when things go wrong? Is that a major constraint?
I think that failure is a big challenge across government. Because we have so many, we're stewards of public money, so we have to be very responsible about it. And I think as a result, we are often as conservative as possible. One of the things that we've found and that we think is a path through that is taking risks that's commensurate with your investment. And so when we're taking risks with small investments, like with some of our open innovation competitions, we make very highly risky bets of $100,000 at a time. And we haven't gotten a lot of grief for many of those things failing because they're small bets. In order to embrace more failure as government, we need to learn how to make smaller bets at the same time, because you can't take that same risk with a $100 million program.
Good. Jane, you see the issue of metrics across multiple corporations and with your academic hat on. So are there best practices out there? Is there a key model?
I don't think there are, but I think the trends that all the three other panelists have highlighted are definitely underway in a lot of the companies I speak to where, getting the balance right between quantitative and qualitative. Secondly, that tension, yes, we need to measure some things, but don't try and measure everything. And so that balance right between the costs of measurement and the benefits. And then I think the benefits of M&E, and I just want to build on what Anne May said, the accountability issue is still there. And I think there's going to be a lot of onus on the companies as there's more and more talk about the role of private sector in development. You know, there's still a lot of skeptics out there. So there is an accountability driver for M&E. But what I'd like to think is that, particularly in the partnership field, it becomes a sort of a mutual accountability driver where, you know, we're sort of partly holding each other to account, not just a donor holding the beneficiary to account. And then secondly, I think M&E as a basis for learning is absolutely critical. And then linked to that, the incredible potential in a lot of these partnerships for M&E to be a basis of capability building on the ground, and the capability building of local partners, local community organizations, et cetera, that one uses the conversation about, well, what have the outcomes been, what have been some of the challenges, to have sort of participation of beneficiaries, using social media and other ways to really build sort of capability on the ground to hold all of us to account.
Okay, I'm turning the program over to you. Madeline has a microphone. No, Josh has a microphone. And so please state your name and be brief. Why don't you take the two gentlemen right here in the middle of the aisle there.
Thank you. I'm Sandy Apgar from Baltimore, and I set up the U.S. Army's PPP for military housing, now in its 20th year, incidentally. The question to all of you is whether this extraordinary fact base and set of insights could be applied to the American inner city, although this is an AID initiative, as I understand it. The material, and certainly the descriptions that you all have given, strike me as very relevant to what we all are grappling with as citizens, as residents, as others. And if there is an initiative in there somewhere, and it may not be AID, I understand, but AID may be an extraordinary source of inspiration for this, which coming into this, I would not have expected, quite frankly.
Actually, the gentleman right in front of him had a question, too.
My name is Glenn Schweitzer. I was the first director of the first science and technology office in USAID many years ago.
Wow, great.
And at that time, we were talking the same issues you're talking about now. It didn't take long to know that the way the developing countries were doing things, we could do much better. But there was one major stumbling block. Developing country people were pretty perceptive. They said, well, if your companies come in here and pick all the pearls, what's left for our companies? Your companies are going where you can make the most money. Well, we want our companies to go where they can make the most money. And so this was a way to just continue colonialization of the developing countries. And let me give you two specific examples, but you've gone a long ways. You must have overcome that somehow. I'm not quite sure. But there are two specific examples. The companies always wanted tax breaks. They wanted tax breaks that the local companies wouldn't get. Now, does USAID allow them to take tax breaks that the local people can't have tax breaks? The USAID has a lot of clout to force the Ministry of Finance to give them tax breaks. Secondly, intellectual property. Now, this may be more a dream than reality, but it was very big in their minds. The way aid solved that problem was there's an aid agreement with every aid country. It's renegotiated every so often. In those aid agreements in those days, it was always written, any IPR developed under the auspices of AID, the IPR would go to the local participants. It would not go. This was an aid program. It's not a money-making program. So if there's money to be made through IPR, it would go to the locals. So would you address those last two issues rather than trying to answer my global question?
All right, Jane, why don't you start on the first one?
Yep.
On applying this domestically, and then ask Anne May and the rest to pick up.
No, I think there's enormous opportunity to apply it domestically, and I think both of the companies on our panel are doing that. So there's a number of initiatives, the Initiative for the Competitive Inner City, which is trying to bring together groups of larger companies to build supply chains with sort of, you know, lower income producers in American inner cities. There's something called the 100,000 Opportunities Initiative, which is a youth based, sort of city based, but looking for opportunities to support youth employment, youth training, youth entrepreneurship. The Resilient Cities Initiative, which has started with a sort of a resilience from a climate perspective, but then realized that you needed the broader sort of community resilience, social resilience, and it's a global program, but American cities as well. So, I think the idea of intentionally learning between some of the collective action partnerships that USAID is supporting internationally and bringing that back, I'm not sure if that's happening, but I think there'd be some real potential there. So,
Anne, you want to address the second question?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. It's great to hear that we're still tackling the same challenges. Hopefully, we'll make a little bit of progress. But sort of to your two questions, you know, one of the things we really look at is, you know, when we look at the systems perspective on a lot of these partnerships is really trying to take the distortions out of the market, right? And so I haven't been directly involved in things that involve tax breaks to companies. It's certainly not something we encourage, but in generally, we're trying to foster a fair competitive marketplace. And I actually believe, and maybe this is a philosophical thing, that for the local companies, it is actually serves them better to be in sort of head-to-head fair competition because it forces them to get better. We've seen that market competition in the U.S. and around the world, that when there's competition, forces all the companies to up their game. And so I think that's a good thing, and I think it needs to be on a level playing field. You know, one of the things, for example, that we look at is with the off-grid solar system companies that we're supporting in different countries, a lot of times they're trying to compete against on-grid electricity that's subsidized in some way, or kerosene that's subsidized in some way. And so, again, we're just trying to figure out how to level the playing field so that the market forces can create fair competition. On the IPR question, I believe that these days when we fund innovations, and this is sort of outside the partnership space, but when we fund innovations, the IPR language in there basically says that the any IP created would be made available at public good prices for public good purposes, right? So in some cases, somebody may come up with an invention for like a low-power refrigerator that they might, or low-cost medical device that they might make money on in the developed country. So they might sell it in the U.S. for a markup and then sell it at cost in developing countries, which is another way to make businesses sustainable that we think is actually very positive.
Good. Joanna, sorry.
Yes, there's a lot of room for application of these principles and strategies domestically. And I was somewhat surprised when I came to Chevron a couple of years ago at the depth of the engagement in the U.S. We follow the same stakeholder engagement, design model, advisory board, set of principles in designing our programs in the U.S. We have a specific program partnership in Richmond, California, where there's a large refinery that was designed to really engage the community and have better relations. So very similar principles. It really comes down to talking and listening to people and understanding what they're saying. And then I think just, you know, so someone made the comment to me a few days ago, hey, partnership is in our DNA. It's in our business DNA. And every country where Chevron operates around the world, the vast, vast majority of employees are host country nationals. We're in joint ventures with the, you know, state-owned companies or the local companies. There's a tremendous amount of business partnership. You know, we're talking kind of about the social partnership. There's a tremendous amount of business partnership that really gets at local workforce training, education, that I think is kind of an undertold story.
Yeah, I would just say from our perspective, I think we've evolved a bit in that we're already in those markets, so we're existing there. And so we're not really looking about market entry. We're looking at how do we make those markets that we're in more competitive? Being in a food business, naturally we're going to work with local sourcing. It makes much more sense to source locally, and the majority of our businesses overseas are groceries. And so what we're really looking at is, you know, what's the best way to foster economic growth, to hire the right kind of people and create opportunities for more underserved populations? Because that leads to more sustainable communities, which in the end, with an enlightened self-interest, leads to a better business in those markets. And so I don't think it's as linear anymore. And I think in terms of like big multinational crowds out small business, I'm sure that happens and I know it happens. But I think there's also an expectation of the countries we're in that we're going to take a mindset of growth and inclusive growth, and that your business is no longer, there has to be a social good in your business. It's very hard to, you know, I just think that the norms have changed, and that's also why businesses are looking at different ways of operating to create much more sustainable business platforms.
And I think just building on that, I was also struck by one of the statistics of your research. If I think I remember correctly, 52% of the number of companies that USAID are working with are local companies, mm-hmm. your domestic companies in the developing countries. And so I think, you know, it's a great example of how USAID has shifted, that it is working with US companies, but it's also increasingly working with domestic local companies and domestic business associations and building that domestic business capability so that it can be able to compete more internationally.
Okay, another round. We've got a couple people up here. Josh, yeah.
Tom Outlaw, Partnerships and Innovation Advisor at AID. I wanted to give a shout out to Brookings. This is the second time I've been here this week. My IQ always goes up when I walk in the door, but it drops immediately when I leave, so I have to keep coming back for a top-up. I was pleased to read in the report about the corporate interviews that were done and the comment or the critique that one of the big barriers is the misalignment of languages between the public and private. And why don't you folks at AID have more private sector folks who can at least speak our language, if not actually have a little experience there? And having left AID 10 years ago, going to the private sector and come back, I was very happy to see that in there. And I would like to just give a testimony to something I heard Chris Juergens say at the State Department yesterday, that the agency and the Global Development Lab is trying to build a cadre of partnership ninjas, to coin a phrase, whose day job it is to do this stuff. And unless and until you have that team and that cohort so that it is in the DNA and there is institutional memory and the incentive alignment is there to do this stuff, not because the way I used to do it, I liked it and I was good at it, but because my annual evaluation is going to be determined on the basis of the quality and quantity of deals that get done. So I think that's a real sea change that I've seen in the last decade. And I think it's a testament to what Anne May's tried to inculcate, both here in HQ and also, more importantly, in the field, where a lot of these folks really do have this as their day job.
Good. Thanks for that comment.
Wanted to connect one dot from the earlier Brookings meeting that I was at, just because I think it is so relevant, which is the extent to which you all think the outcomes-based/impact bond mode of investing, and I'm going to coin the term here, is partnerships 5.0, just to one-up Eric Postel. Because having seen this and having seen a lot of thought leadership from both Brookings and Harvard on this, and knowing that Anne May is trying to create the mental space inside AID to really catch up with where the domestic scene is, what you all see is the opportunity. It seems a really, really game-changing way to align philanthropic impact-seeking and just straight-up return-seeking capital in a really, really powerful and effective way. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you guys very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, George, can I just make a quick comment there, which is, you know, I think we're all on this journey together. I do still feel like there's some structural challenges mm-hmm. at AID that make it that, you know, before we leave here and say we're all going to partner forever, it's hard sometimes. It's much easier to partner with USAID when there is almost a presidential directive, Power Africa, Feed the Future, where the center and the field is oriented around a common goal. For us, there's much more data on what's going on. Yeah. There are people in the center can help connect us to the field. And, you know, I think this is an evolution that we're all going on together. But it is structured. I've had a lot of, you know, colleagues of mine saying, I don't know, how do you navigate? We can't navigate it because they may not be aligned around power or food, or some of these bigger initiatives. And so I think that's just a challenge we should throw out there, too, that if we're going to be more nimble, we need to be telling people up the hill, you can't constrain us this way and tell us how we have to do our business. You have to let us be a little more nimble and more flexible, too.
Good. Josh, there's another question right over here. This lady.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm a consultant who works on development and occasionally corporate responsibility. And about 24 years ago, I was working on ivermectin and river blindness. And about a dozen and a half years ago, I was working in a corporation trying to apply some of these development principles, as you're doing now. And thank you so much for your insights. I can see such a marvelous evolution of this PPP approach. And I welcome Brookings' studies on this very important topic. Now, partnerships. A number of you have talked about the similar principles and processes that you see between USAID and corporate entities, and that's important to that partnership. But there's a double partnership when companies and USAID together are working as partners in an emerging economy, because the partnership is between them and then them together with the local population. And how does the local population perceive that partnership? What are the expectations that the local population may have of a Walmart or a Chevron that they would not have of an AID? And how does this affect your project and the success of your outcome?
Let's take one more question. Hand the microphone to that gentleman right there.
And hi, everyone. I'm
because we're running out of time.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to say something a little controversial today. We're a small company that manufactured in the United States. We're succeeding throughout Africa and the Middle East. We produced a house called the Tropicalized House. We're succeeding with other government organizations, but we can't seem to get anywhere with USAID. So I look forward to speaking with you after the conference. I have one-page brochures. We have no debts, no mortgage, no liabilities, and no skeletons. We manufacture a house in Mississippi, and we're looking to help more people in Africa. I'm on television in Africa. If you go on YouTube and type in Omni Housing, we can't seem to get anywhere with USAID. Thank you for listening to this commercial.
We may have to charge you
for being
here. I
think the question
here
is, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Real quick on the social impact investing bonds, I was struck by that report that one of my colleagues wrote analyzing 60 or 68 bonds that have been done over the last few years. What struck me is that none of them have been at scale, and to my surprise, none of them have involved innovation. That tells me that we are at the birthing stage of social impact bonds, and we have no idea what their future is like and where they're headed, and are they going to be something that really takes off.
I had a timing to that, and there it's sort of only one element, I agree with what George was saying, but of the broader impact investing field. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the role of philanthropists and sort of smaller players in the impact investing field. I think one of the big game changers potentially is to get some of the institutional investors, and, you know, we're gradually beginning to see that in the big pension funds, and, you know, think about what are the ways that, you know, just a tiny percentage of large institutional investment funds that could go into supporting some of the grand challenge programs, et cetera, I think would be a real game changer in terms of mobilizing private finance.
And I just want to thank Tom for the shout out about our partnerships team. We're going to change Chris here, who leads the partnerships team business card, to Director of Partnership Ninjas. and I think one
thing. He dressed up, he doesn't have his green suit on today.
I know.